and welcome to the Primordial Soup Pot. My name is Rustin. I'm here with my co-host.
Hi, I'm Aaron.
Every couple of weeks, Aaron and I will get together to talk about some wild and wonderful topics within the world of ecology, evolution, and natural history. And this time around, we're talking about spring.
And spring is probably the best season, I think, for topics, because that is when so many animals are either coming out of hibernation, they are emerging from pupas or eggs. Everything kind of comes to life at this time.
Right, right. A lot of really dramatic change and a lot of really dramatic topics to talk about. So, with that being said, I believe I'm up first this time around, yeah?
Yep. What do you have for me?
Okay, so for my piece, I'm going to start by taking you not just to a location where something cool happens in spring, but to one specific spring, specifically the spring of 1993 in Southern California. At this point in time, a group of editors and other post-production staff are all working for a director named Steven Spielberg on what will soon be one of the most iconic blockbusters in the history of Hollywood. That movie, of course, would be Jurassic Park. Now, beyond all the expected obstacles involved with filming a movie of this scale, you know, things like coordinating cameras, actors, makeup, special effects, etc.
The dinosaurs, they were really hard to coordinate, I imagine.
Yes, totally. There was an additional challenge involved here, because they were filming a movie about dinosaurs when no one knew what dinosaurs looked like, really. This meant that they had to consult with paleontologists on how different dinosaurs could have appeared based on the research available at the time. But even more than this, arguably the bigger challenge was that they didn't know what dinosaurs sounded like either. So This is an even bigger challenge, in my opinion, because it's far more complicated and open to interpretation, right? When you're trying to think about the appearance of a dinosaur, at least you have the skeleton to go on. You know the general shape, and so you can kind of fill everything out from there and, you know, pick and, you know, decide on a color that seemed most likely. But with the sound, you know, who knows, right? Like, you can maybe think about, like, the shape of the head in terms of how that determined what sounds the dinosaurs could have made, but you're really shooting in the dark here in a lot of cases, you know, because there's no way to fossilize a sound, right? So, the guy in charge of this was named Gary Rydstrom, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, and he decided to use modified sounds of various animals to create the auditory profile of Jurassic Park's dinosaurs. And a really important part of the park, of course, is the T-Rex. So those particular sounds were really important. And for this one, Rydstrom decided to combine different sounds of different animals because he couldn't really find just one that worked, or that he felt really captured the T-Rex. So after a lot of trial and error, he wound up with this combination of elephant, tiger, and Jack Russell Terrier sounds, oddly enough. But there was still something missing that he felt would really bring the T-Rex to life.
Is it a giant metal spring? Because I'm not sure how this is connecting to the season, the spring.
Well, first of all of this is happening in the spring of 1993. But I'm getting
to that. I
like
my giant metal spring idea. It gives it a sort of a rustic twang.
In any case, turns out to find the extra sound that he was looking for the T-Rex, all he had to do was travel to a swamp in the southeastern United States at the exact same time of year that he was thinking about this. Because that missing element was the bellowing sounds made by alligators, which is the broader spring event that I'm going to be discussing. So yeah, I told you I'd bring it around.
What is this, the great alligator opera of 93?
Not of 93 in particular, but that is definitely a sign of spring in the southeastern United States. So bellowing is kind of a general term that's used to describe a wide range of alligator vocalizations made by both males and females. And these vocalizations have a variety of different purposes, right? So in some cases, they are used territorially. Gators are generally solitary, so the bellows help distinguish the home turf of one gator from another. However, they're most commonly performed in the spring because this is the breeding season. So on mornings in the spring, gators will engage in these bouts of bellowing, you know, this kind of auditory competition. Not unlike birds that will sing back and forth at each other. Same kind of thing. And in general, the gator who can continue the bout for longer is considered the winner. The gators take a single breath before engaging in one of these bouts, so if an individual has more lung capacity, they can win more bouts, and lung capacity is strongly correlated to body size. So, in essence, the bellowing helps the gators determine the relative size of the others around them, right? So, this is really important during the breeding season when the females want to mate with the biggest and strongest males, and they can just listen to these bouts and figure out, you know, who's the top dog around here, basically. It also means that the males rarely have to fight to determine who is the most physically dominant. Instead, they can just kind of roar at each other across the swamps. So this is kind of like two rival gym bros at the club who determine dominance by bragging about how much they can bench instead of going out and punching each other. Same kind of deal, right? However, this particular behavior is especially a spring behavior because during this time of year, they actually have a part of their bellowing behavior which is audible to humans because it has such a low frequency. This bit occurs before their actual audible sounds. So they'll perform the inaudible aspect and then do the actual roar that humans can hear. And they do this while they're underwater. The frequency of this particular sound is so low-pitched and powerful that it actually vibrates everything around their bodies, which, of course, includes the water. So this will cause the water drops to spring up around them, and in some cases, these water drops can reach almost a foot above the surrounding water surface. So this creates this, like, vibrating water dance effect. And so, this particular behavior is called the water dance.
Okay, you get a whole theater performance out of it.
Yeah, exactly. It's like it makes it sound like a ballet. You know, it's really whimsical.
You know what I say? If you don't like the tuba solo, put him in a bathtub, and then he's incredible.
Yeah, you get that water dancing because of all the tuba sounds. Oh, it's great.
You should have seen my marching band at the local pool. It was a spectacle.
They had a hard time moving around, but man, they were really entertaining.
Oh, the brass section, they went straight down, straight to the bottom. I think one kid's still down there, actually.
So it is thought that the water dance helps signal to other gators underwater, while the audible part that people hear is heard by gators on land. So because of the relatively amphibious nature of gators, it makes sense that their territorial displays are similarly amphibious. They have a bit that's meant to be understood by gators underwater and another bit that's meant to be understood by gators on land. So it's pretty efficient if you think about it. But really, to me at least, what's most fascinating about the bellows is that they're highly individualistic. Because the sound produced by each gator depends on the characteristics of the alligator's body. And because no two gators are quite alike or have the exact same body shape, it means that no two bellows are exactly the same. And this is in the same way that no two people are exactly alike, right? We all have different body shapes and sizes. Same applies for alligators. But because they're sounds are tied so heavily to their body shape, their sounds are incredibly individualistic. So it could be possible for scientists to really passively monitor gators in swamps based solely on what are basically their auditory fingerprints. So you could just take a microphone, you know, paddle through a swamp, hear, you know, collect all the gator sounds, and then if you have this database, you can match up each gator bellow to an individual and know which gators are around you, basically, based solely on these calls, because they're that individualistic. So that's really cool, honestly, to me. And furthermore, to bring this full circle, since alligators and dinosaurs had the same common ancestor, because they're both reptiles, it's possible that some dinosaurs could have used a similar type of bellowing behavior to communicate with other individuals in the area without actually fighting each other. So, in a way, it was really appropriate for the sound designer in Jurassic Park to use alligator bellows to help bring the T-Rex to life in that movie.
I listen to many podcasts, but I listened to Terrible Lizards. I recommend it if you're into paleontology. And he did an episode about what the T-Rex would sound like. And he did mention, with crocodilians, of course, being a close relative, that that would probably be a more accurate description. The funniest thing he said was, why would they roar before they chase their prey? Because if you're chasing after your prey, that's the last thing you want to do, is yell and let them know that you're coming at them. That was an irk he had with it. He brought that up many times.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess you do it because you're a drama queen. You want everyone to know that you're hunting. I don't know.
It's all about showmanship, I guess.
I guess so. I can't think of any other reason. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Maybe he's trying to intimidate the prey with like a war cry.
You know what? I don't think he has to do a war cry. And if, again, they usually yell, chase the people, and then 9 out of 10 times, they got the plot armor and they slip into a hole or something. If you had just run at them and not yelled, I mean, you could have nabbed them.
Maybe. That's true. Although, it's also possible that that roar is more like an actual war cry, in that it's just to, you know, psych himself up and increase the dinosaur's sense of courage, because, you know, the dinosaur deep down is actually afraid of the people, and so the dinosaur needs to roar to really get themselves in the mood.
Hype himself up.
Otherwise, they just get scared and chicken out.
Again, it's like a bald eagle is about to swoop down on, let's say, like, there's a rabbit. It doesn't just screech, like, I'm coming at you, I'm gonna get you, when it's, like, still in the sky. Because then the rabbit is like, oh, I should probably not sit here anymore. The stealth aspect is gone.
Yeah, but it looks really cool when they do, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does look cool. Can't argue with that.
And it's just the Jurassic Park movies, man. That's really all they were concerned with at the end of the day. But in essence, that's my piece. So I started off with a specific spring and brought it into spring in general. See, I told you we'd get there in the end.
Yeah, we got there in the end. So if you're, I guess, depending on what part of the Southeast you're in, do you hear alligators like you would frogs?
More or less, yeah. Especially in spring.
Yeah. I wonder if, like, I don't know, maybe you got a back porch facing a swamp, if that's what you hear.
Sure.
Might be a little alarming, too.
Yeah, and from everything that I read, it's basically like part of the morning chorus. You know, in a lot of the United States, and throughout the world, really, we're used to waking up and hearing birds singing at each other. And in a lot of the Southeast United States, alligators just happen to be a very large part of that, especially in the swamps.
Well, cool piece. And I like the fact about it with Jurassic Park.
Yeah, I thought that'd be a cool tie-in. But anyway, what have you got for me?
So I'm actually, my topic is very similar in a number of ways.
Okay.
In that it is in spring, in the southeast.
Well, of course, and... it's in the spring. Of course, okay, it would be similar in that respect, Aaron.
And it also involves mating rituals or courtship behaviors.
Oh, okay.
With a lot of showmanship, too.
Go on.
Okay, so I also have a little scenario I'll walk you through. So, imagine you're walking through a forest in May. So, kind of a late spring, but still spring. And you're in the mountains of North Carolina. It's very humid out, but not too hot. And the sun is setting. As night comes around, you start to see some faint lights around you on the forest floor, kind of swirling and spiraling. Suddenly you see more of these constant faint lights all around you, and fireflies. But rather than flashing, they actually stay lit for a minute at a time and just keep swirling. And of course, there's one other notable difference. They're all glowing a pale blue. And this is the blue ghost firefly. Have you heard of these?
I have. I actually looked at this topic.
Are you kidding me?
I'm being totally serious. I thought very seriously about doing this as a topic for this podcast. And I ended up going with the alligators. Turns out there's a very solid chance that we would have been talking about the same thing.
Oh, wow.
I didn't do too much research into it, so there's probably a lot of your piece that I don't know.
I did as much in depth as I could, but again, with a lot of the topics that I find, Google Scholar after four papers, it's nothing. You'll get citations or references, but yeah. There's only so much to read.
Yeah.
Anyways, so I'll start off with a bit of the background on the fireflies, and then I'll go into the blue ghost specifically, their life cycle and the ecology. So, as you know, the blue ghost firefly is a species of beetle, not an actual fly, in the Lampridae family. And this is the family that contains all other firefly species. If you've ever caught a firefly in your backyard before, these guys look about the same, just a bit darker in color. And they only get about a quarter of an inch in length, so about the size of a grain of rice. So smaller and darker than your average firefly. The life cycle of these fireflies is not unique among the species. They undergo complete metamorphosis, so egg, larva, pupa, adult, like many insects.
Right.
However, there have not been any eggs, larva, or pupa ever discovered in the wild, and most likely due to their small range and even smaller size.
So we only know about the egg, larva, pupa part based on captive individuals?
Yeah, there's been some captive rearing.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And I believe they have taken wild specimens and have them lay eggs, and they've seen like the behavior in the larva. But I don't think there's been any larva just straight up discovered. Again, they're so tiny. So it's a big force to cover, too.
So why have we never found any in the wild? Is it just because we're terrible at looking for them?
They're tiny, they have an extremely limited range, and they live under the dirt. So,
hasn't
you knocked yourself out.
Hasn't stopped us before.
Yeah, but I don't know if there's a very strong incentive to do so.
Aaron, knowing how both of our brains work, and knowing that there are quite a few other people whose brains work in a very similar way, you think that there aren't people who would spend days digging in the dirt looking for the eggs and pupa of a very specific type of beetle?
Well, it's probably good that they don't, and I'll actually get to that later.
Oh, okay. Carry on then.
I could not find any specific information about this species' diets, but typically larval fireflies are carnivores, and they feed on a variety of different insects, worms, and slugs, whereas adults will feed on nectar/pollen, or they don't feed at all, and they just focus on breeding, and then they die.
Oh, so they become pacifists in old age.
Some species. And most species don't feed. Others, the adults, are carnivores as well, but it does not occur in this genus.
So they go from hawks to doves. It's a really interesting transition.
Not all of them, but yeah. I mean, if you think about it, caterpillars to butterflies, one is like a plant's best friend and the other is very much the opposite.
Yeah, fair.
So if we follow the normal lifespan of these, the firefly larvae hatch from eggs, grow, pupate, and emerge as adults. Well, this is only true for the male fireflies. So that's the first interesting thing about these fireflies. The females display paedomorphism. And that's something we've talked about before. It's when the adult of a species still exhibits the larval traits. And one example we come back to time and time again, the axolotl.
Yep.
The salamanders retain their larval gills into adulthood. They never fully metamorphosize and go on the land, even though other members of the same genus will.
Yep. These are the basement dwellers.
They are. They never leave the parents' crib.
Yeah, exactly.
So in the blue ghost fireflies, the females never develop into winged adults. They simply keep growing into essentially larger larvae. They actually can get bigger than the males, and they can still glow, but they never get their wings. They also never get the same developed antenna or eyes like the males do.
Okay.
So they kind of stay in this grub-like shape. And many different firefly species have paedomorphic females, actually. And this is why they're sometimes referred to as glowworms due to their, like I said, grub-like shape.
Okay, yeah. I had heard about that.
So glowworms, fireflies, same thing. Varies across the species, though.
Got it. Okay.
Of course, the most interesting part about these fireflies is the glowing. All fireflies glow in order to attract mates. In these guys, the glowing rituals trigger about an hour after sunset. It has to be on a cool, moist night, but not on a rainy night. Usually, this will occur like the day after a big rainstorm, in late May to early June. They also come out in their largest numbers during a new moon or a cloudy night with the most darkness.
Okay, so dark, moist, cool, late May, early June. I got everything right so far?
Oh, one more thing. Ooh. Most fireflies...
But wait, there's more.
There's more. Most fireflies that you see flashing, they're in tall grassy fields. That's their go-to, which is great for viewing them because you can kind of, if you're driving on a back road in like early June, you can just pull over and watch them. These guys actually prefer to stay in forests. They really like canopy coverage. They also really like thick layers of dead leaves and usually like to be near streams or another small body of water. So this is a lot of really specific conditions for them.
Yeah. Yeah, they're really picky.
They are very picky. They like, rarely leave these forests, too. They do not venture out in the fields.
They're so picky they should be featured on an episode of House Hunters.
Are people picky on that show?
Very picky.
Yeah, I feel like some of it's just showmanship, you know? Like, there's no fun. They probably show them, like, six shitty homes just to mess with them a little bit. And they're like, all right, this is the real one. Right, because if you got the good home right off the bat, it wouldn't be a good episode.
I mean, sure, but like...
When was the last time they had the humblest, like, most thankful person on the show? Is like, oh yeah, this one's good. This is fine. I love holes in the floor. I just throw my trash down there. I mean, tree fell through the ceiling? No, that's a skylight, and I'm one with nature.
I mean, no, that they don't ever have that, but a lot of the intrigue of... Actually, I wouldn't know what the intrigue of an episode of House Hunters is because I've never been intrigued by an episode of House Hunters. At best, I've watched it when it was on in the waiting room of a doctor's office. But I'd imagine the intrigue is that you get shown a bunch of houses and then you spend the episode wondering which one is the good house. And then they tell you at the end. That's the intrigue.
Again, I feel like they have to throw in like some red herrings there, like that this house is terrible. You know, we just want to mess with you a little bit, make you squirm a little.
I mean, sure.
Because you know that production team, they can find that perfect house right off the bat.
Maybe.
They probably have enough experience. They can go, okay, we know exactly what you need. Find the house. Right.
But the original point that I was trying to make here is that the people on that show have like a ridiculous number of like qualifying characteristics for a house. And I'm like, you're not going to be able to get all those. You're like, we want to be in the Midwest, but also on a beach and in the woods. And it's got to be like a 5-bedroom house that costs like $10. Like, No, that's never happening. Anyway.
Maybe it's the people. Maybe they go for the people that are really picky.
Well, yeah, because those
maybe
are the
people. Sort them out.
Those are the people that'll make ultimately make good TV.
Yeah, can't deny that at the end of the day.
Imagine if, like, on The Bachelor or Bachelorette, they were just, like, the person immediately was just, like, looked around the room of, like, you know, 20 potential candidates and was just like, you, I want you. The rest can, you know, get out of here.
Or alternatively, there's, like, one doctor, lawyer, model, philanthropist, billionaire, and everyone else was just some guys they pulled off the street.
Yeah, and there's always that one dude who shows up on the first episode wearing like a weird penguin costume or some shit.
So I was thinking like an ankle monitor.
Or better yet, just a prison jumpsuit.
They wheel him in with the full Hannibal Lecter getup. Anyways, so yes, these guys are picky with their habitats. Now, all the fireflies glow with their abdomens. With the blue ghosts, they actually have two different spots that can light up, two different segments. So they could have both lit or one at the other at the same time. But what is unique about the blue ghosts is that most fireflies only flash for a second, and when they do, it is a pattern specific to the species that allows them to find a female of the same species.
Right.
In fact, remember how I said that some fireflies are carnivores as adults?
Yeah.
There are species of fireflies where the females will lie in the grass and mimic the flashes of a different firefly species to attract a male of that different species, and then she'll eat him.
Whoa.
It's just kind of a cool strategy.
It's a very cool strategy. It's also kind of messed up.
Yeah, it is a little messed up, especially because they're very closely related.
Yeah.
It's like a chimpanzee in drag. It just kills you.
I was going to say it sounds like the Tinder swindler if he was an insect, but sure, that works too.
Yeah. Yeah, so the males of the blue ghosts, they don't flash. They just stay lit, which is, you know, pretty cool for fireflies, for up to a minute. So you just see this pulsating, flickering light moving and swirling around. And while they don't flash, they can change the intensity of their light. And like I said, it gives it a sort of flickering effect, which is, you know, pretty cool to see, especially if you see hundreds of them all at once.
Sure, sure.
The males fly just above the ground, swirling around erratically, which causes a cool swirling effect. It almost feels like you're standing in a patch of lights, or you're kind of immersed in the Starry Night painting.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
The females will either be just on top of or slightly under the spongy leaf piles on the ground. Again, they need forests with these big piles of dead, moist leaves.
They like to pretend that it's fall, even in the spring.
Yep. They will also light up to attract the males. However, because of their colorless exoskeleton, again, they're pedomorphic, they don't develop like the males. The females, it looks like their entire body is shining sometimes, even though it's just the abdomen, but again, they don't have colors, so the whole thing kind of lights up. So, eventually, the male and the female fireflies link up, do the deed, continue on with their business, circle of life.
Sure. Sure.
What's interesting about it is it doesn't really make sense for the male fireflies to glow.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess not.
Because after all, they just need to find the females. I mean, that's the end goal. They have to find the females who are on the ground and also lighting up. So right. It kind of makes you think, why did the males even bother when it just puts them at risk to predators?
Yeah.
I found three possible hypotheses to this. The first one, male fireflies glow to signal to females to release specific hormones that might identify them as potential mates. So you can think of it as a sort of ping the males use to announce they're in the neighborhood, and then the females that are interested will signal back. So it is to alert the males to the females, is alert the females that the males are here, and then they can put on the proper pheromones and light display.
Hmm. Okay.
Hypothesis two is that the males glow to illuminate their surroundings, which I think is a bit weaker, personally. because it's been found that sometimes male fireflies will go after dying or trapped female fireflies. It mentioned how they will sometimes like fly into spiders' webs to go after a female that's about to be eaten. So it mentioned that this might help them navigate better, the little bit of illumination. But I don't know about this one.
I don't know if the illumination will help them get out of a spider's web.
Well, it's another thing is they said it might help them navigate the leaves better because, again, the females are kind of, they're on the ground, so maybe it helps them light up for the landing better.
Okay,
it's like their own portable runway.
That's fair. That's fair.
And three, it may be a way to show that these males are well-equipped against predators, so their glowing may showcase that they are toxic to predators and thus a good candidate for mating.
Hmm.
It could be a warning system to would-be predators that I taste bad. And many species of fireflies are toxic, although it varies in lethality between species, and it also varies on what's eating them. Because, at least for spiders, they don't seem to care. Yeah. Actually, quite a few bugs don't care. Maybe it's only bats. Or people. Don't eat fireflies. They are toxic to us.
I wonder how many people have actually tried that.
Well, I'm sure they taste rancid because, I mean, I've caught fireflies as a kid and they kind of smell.
Probably. Never tried those, so I don't know for sure. I can't offer a first-hand account here.
Yeah, don't research this one for us. We'll just let it remain a mystery. I'm okay with this one.
We're fine living in ignorance.
Yeah, I'm okay with this one. But of course, the most important question is, why are they blue? Every other firefly is kind of a yellow-green. Did you happen to read about why they're blue?
I did not, but I assumed they're just trying to stand out. They want to be cool. Trying to send a trend.
Here's the thing. They're actually green.
Okay.
Yeah, so they flash at the same light frequency as other firefly species. In fact, one study even recreated the firefly bioluminescent proteins and put it in E. coli bacteria, and it's the same color as every other firefly.
So why does it appear blue?
So it's actually an optical illusion. These fireflies appear blue to something known as the Purkinje effect. And this is when the human eye will sometimes register colors differently in very low light settings. So, for example, under very low light conditions, red seems darker than other colors. And that's why sometimes deep sea animals are red instead of black, because the red light waves don't travel that far down. So it's essentially camouflage, even though if you took them up to the surface, they stand out. Well, in this case, under very low light conditions, sometimes it can shift and it looks blue from a distance. So when you're surrounded in a forest by these fireflies, they look pale blue from a distance, but if you saw one up close, it would look yellow-green.
Interesting.
So unfortunately, that does mean if you want to experience the magic of these fireflies, you have to do it in person. You can't rely on a photo or a video.
That's cool to consider, but wait, why does this happen with this particular kind of firefly instead of all fireflies?
So, I could not figure out why it happens with these specifically. I imagine one factor might be habitat. So, they're in very dark forests. This is probably the least amount of light you're going to get, whereas most other fireflies are in open fields. And it would allow a lot more moonlight. I wonder if it's also because they remain lit for an extended period. They don't just flash in a pattern. But, you know what? Maybe it's just one big hoax. You know, it's just a gag that everyone's in on, except us.
There's just a bunch of hill folk in North Carolina that are shining off blue Christmas lights in the spring just to prank everybody.
No, I was thinking the fireflies are real, but they're just regular fireflies. And they're like, oh, they're blue, but only in person. Cameras don't work. And when you show up, maybe they, I imagine they're laughing in their rocking chairs like the two guys from the SpongeBob movie.
They're just roasting you. Or like those two guys from the Muppets. Just in the gallery.
Even better. So, like I said, you have to experience these in person if you really want to see them, and that's what people do. So, Firefly tourism has become increasingly popular all across the world, not just for these specifically, because many Firefly species have these fantastic breeding displays that happen all at once.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see one of those.
Yeah. Like I said, I mean, just driving down the back road in June, you go by a field, I'd pull over just to see the fireflies for a minute. I'm fortunate enough to live by a field that gets filled with them in June. Not a ton, but enough that I can appreciate them.
Sure, sure. Sounds like there's already a country song about this.
Like, fireflies?
Owl City? Well, definitely the part about driving down a back road, but driving down a back road and seeing glowing fireflies, yeah.
You would not believe your eyes.
Yeah, see,
10,000 fireflies. It's not quite a country song, but...
Oh, that's definitely not a country song. All I'm saying is that maybe it could be out of something there.
Yeah, that could be a cover of it.
Yeah, throw in some beer or whiskey and you're well on your way.
I was just thinking a banjo and a fiddle.
That too.
Yeah, that might be a bit too bluegrassy, though.
Yeah, that's getting into a slightly different genre.
Anyways... for many people, you don't have fireflies living by you, so this is really the only way to experience them in person. These fireflies are scattered throughout the southern Appalachian Mountains. You can find them at Chimney Rock State Park, Pisgah National Forest, and the most popular spot, DuPont State Recreational Forest.
Hmm.
There are several tours you can book online. I found some on Asheville Hiking Tours, but unfortunately they're all sold out for this year. A lot of them, it seems like they actually go on sale at the end of the year prior. So if you want to go 2025, you should start looking at December tours, or you should start looking in December of this year.
Gotcha. Okay.
And of course, there are major cons to these tours. Light pollution can disrupt the mating rituals of the blue ghosts, even as little as a camera flash. They don't allow any photography on these that can disrupt them. And high foot traffic can lead to habitat alteration, or even worse, accidentally trampling the flightless females. Again, they're tiny and fragile. That's why I said you might not want to go tearing up all through these leaves to try and find one, because these habitats are fragile and few and far between.
Yeah, okay. I see what you mean. It's probably a good thing that we haven't found any eggs or pupa.
But the benefits of these tours far outweighs the cost. So not only is it an incredible experience, but the carefully guided and managed tours can be held without too much disruption of the habitat. The more reputable ones, I mean, not just some guy you find on Craigslist, but like the proper ones you can book, these people have been doing it for a while, they know what they're talking about, and they know where to guide you. Just follow the instructions, stay on the trail, and you should be fine. And a lot of these tours donate money to the parks. The Asheville hiking tours they found donate 50% of the ticket cost to the state parks they go through.
Oh, that's really nice of them.
Mm-hmm. These tours also generate money for local economies and raise awareness for a rather interesting species. And there's still a lot we have to learn about these, and tours can help with that.
Sure. Plus, there's not really a whole lot of tourism based around insects. So that makes it kind of unique.
So that might surprise you, because I didn't realize this until I started researching.
Really?
Firefly tours are actually pretty popular in some parts of the world.
Really?
Again, not the blue ghosts. They don't have the blue ones. However, I found that in some Asian countries like Thailand, firefly tours are a massive part of some local economies, and they draw people in from across the world. These can be massive events.
Are they really?
Yeah, I believe in Thailand, it's actually a species that lives near mangrove swamps, and okay. You can rent boats and go out and see these fireflies above you, and I imagine it's kind of like the lantern scene from Tangled.
Huh. That's really cool.
Yeah. I also found some in Europe as well, Australia. There's quite a few of these where there's fireflies. If they're in large numbers, I'm sure you'll find people. Of course, there's some in the U.S., but at least for the blue ghosts, it's more of a hiking. You really have to work for it. not a super hard trail, but you got to walk in the dark. But with some of the larger ones, with the bigger congregations, I mean, it can literally just be you go out, throw down a blanket, and look up. Maybe have a lunch or a drink, too.
Well, that sounds quite lovely.
It does. It's kind of a sad reality. I've mentioned this before. In order for us to protect a species, there has to be an economic incentive for us to do so.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes protecting a species, because it's important to the environment, isn't enough. But these firefly tours will help ensure that we have fireflies for future generations to see.
Sounds like they should get to experience it at some point as well.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, it's not like we're catching them and grinding them up to make some sort of organic glow stick. We're just looking at them. It's not like open season on the fireflies. Again, be reasonable. Don't go stomping on like all the leaf piles if you're looking for the blue ghosts. But, you know, you're there to appreciate them.
Yeah, we're there to see them in the wild, not to turn them into some kind of Soylent glow stick.
As for the blue ghosts, like I said, there's still a lot to learn about them. When it came to papers for these, I found 4 that were dedicated to the blue ghost, and the rest where they're just mentioned for being blue, for the most part. That whenever there's a firefly paper, they're brought up. As we get increased development and light pollution, these populations will slowly disappear.
Right, yeah.
We don't know their full range. Populations are scattered and limited due to their very specific habitat requirements. They need the densely covered, moist forest with lots of dead leaves. And the females can't fly, so they're not widespread, and this really limits their dispersal. However, as long as we have dedicated researchers and the firefly tours, I think the species will stick around for the foreseeable future.
Okay, good. Good.
And the only last thing I did read, which was kind of interesting, is that some legends say that locals in the South used to see these blue ghost fireflies and think that they were the ghosts of Confederate soldiers. At least one tourism site said that. I don't know if people actually thought that, but it does kind of remind me of the Will-o'-the-Wisps from Irish folklore, which is kind of similar. It's like souls of the departed, except I think those were actually swamp gas. But yeah, I bet there's some really interesting folklore behind these that I just hadn't stumbled across. Because if I saw a bunch of blue lights swirling around me in the middle of a dark forest, I'd piss myself.
Oh.
If I didn't know what a firefly was, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure. If I think I'd be lucky if I only pissed myself. I think there'd be multiple different kinds of excrement coming out. But, yeah, no, totally, that makes a lot of sense. Like, I find it interesting that people, like, knowing our current scientific explanations for these natural phenomena, hear about the myths and legends that cropped up around these phenomena, and think initially, oh, well, that's crazy. Why would you ever think that? But then, like, that makes total sense from that point of view, because, like, if you just saw a bunch of blue lights flashing around you when you were walking through the woods at night, what the hell would you think it was? You know?
And who are you supposed to talk to about this?
Right.
Like, odds are the highest official you have near you is, like, a pastor, and they're not an entomologist.
Yeah, exactly.
Were you going to do consult in the almanac? You might not even be able to read.
Yeah. Half the time you tell everyone else about this, they're just going to think you're crazy.
Yeah, you know what? They've probably seen something, too. They probably just roll with it. Anyways, that is my piece.
Nice, nice. That was really cool. Yeah, so I read about some of the firefly displays in North Carolina when I was trying to pick a topic for this episode. I didn't look that deeply into it, so not nearly as deeply as you did in your piece, but I did think that that would be a good potential topic for an episode, but in the end, I decided to talk about the gators.
Well, it was definitely for the best.
Yeah, I was about to say, I'm glad I did. This would have been a very quick episode. Or maybe it would have been kind of cool, I don't know. I've always wondered what would happen if we, by some really crazy chance, happened to pick the same topic for an episode.
What was it? The monogamy episode where you did the prairie voles. That was a topic I had looked into.
Yes.
Because that was the only case of monogamy I knew about. Because we talked about it in college.
Yes.
And then in the end, I just Googled if there is a monogamous frog, and there was one. I was like, all right, I'll go with this.
Right, right. I remember that. We did talk about that. That, prior to today, was probably the closest we'd come to talking about the same thing.
Yep.
But maybe one day it'll happen, and honestly, I think that'll be a fun episode.
Well, that means we just have to pick more niche topics. Go very specific.
So, speaking of niches, for our next podcast, we're going to be talking about weird niches.
Yep. Weird niches / diets. I found the grape one. It's probably the coolest thing I've ever seen. Yeah, I can't wait to talk about it.
Yeah, you seemed really excited about this one, so I'm looking forward to it. And I think I found a really good topic myself, so it'll be a good one. Make sure you catch that one. But with that decided, you want to take us out?
If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a follow or review on your podcast app of choice. If you have a suggestion for a future episode, you can reach us at SoupPotPodcast at Twitter/X or theprimordialsouppot@gmail.com.
All right. Sounds good. And until next time, I'm Rustin.
And I'm Aaron.
See ya.